From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of The Advice Show. I'm very lucky to be joined today by Dominic Rose, from the CEO at MKC Wealth. Thanks for coming in. A pleasure. First up, I thought it'd be helpful to kind of get to know your background a little bit. So you've always been in M&A and financial advice, including a stint running acquisitions at Quilter, as well as their London office before you arrived at MKC. Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, if I give you a bit of background. So I've been in financial advice sector for nearly 20 years now. I started off at a firm called Towergate Financial, sort of straight out of university. So as a graduate, didn't know anything. But learned quite a lot. So I was an analyst within the M&A team at Towergate, now called Ren Sterling, that business. I left that business 2012 to help set up a firm called Belpenny. It's now called Ascot Lloyd. And I was running the acquisitions there and looking after the teams of financial planners. We grew that business really fast, probably too fast, actually. There's some interesting learning from that, which we can perhaps come on to. I then went on to Quilter in 2016 and helped grow their financial advice business, their national business, not their network. But I left in I should decide to leave in March 2020, so just as lockdown was kicking in, the first lockdown was kicking in, and I wanted to go and build a new wealth management business, really. So that's what sort of led me into MKC, albeit we didn't start the business until October 2021.
Right. So what was that initial vision there with MKC after, I suppose, you had a big institution like Quilter with an enormous presence? To go and, you know, do something on your own, what was the idea?
Yeah, well, the idea was, it was about, I think there are three key principles. The first was, had no aspiration of building the largest business. So it wasn't about sort of a race for scale to go and build to something huge. It was actually about building a business where every member of the team could go home proud at the end of the day of the service that we're delivering to our clients. So it was more around focusing on the quality of the service we're delivering to our clients and understanding that our clients are trusting us with their life savings. And that's a massive responsibility. And I thought I would be better, more able to set that sort of culture within a smaller business that we started sort of from an earlier stage. So that was sort of one key principle. The second was that I wanted every member of the team to help build it and shape it. The principle being we build it together, we share in the value together. So we made everyone a shareholder in that business. Every member of the team's a shareholder. And then the third key principle was that we are a service business, so it shouldn't be rocket science, but we're a service business. And therefore, everybody's remuneration should be, the number one KPI in a business, should be client satisfaction and how happy your clients are. Because the happier your clients are, the better the quality of business. So it was really around just having this really clear vision and idea about what I wanted to be building and bringing some like-minded people along to help do it.
And it's grown quickly in that time. I think you're at 2.5 billion AUM
now? Yeah, you've done your research. We're about 2.5 billion. But I think of it more in terms of, you know, we've got a team of 40 financial planners, five offices, and there's 145 in the team in total, all looking after, doing a good job for our clients. So,
And it's quite fast growth. And you mentioned earlier the kind of dangers and sometimes the too quick growth. Yeah. How have you, kind of, I guess, with those learnings, managed the pace of the expansion?
I think the key thing is we do a reasonably high volume of very small transactions. So we want to be the safe pair of hands to look after clients from retiring advisors, right? So these retiring advisors, they've built up the trust with their clients over many years. The clients typically love them, right? Absolutely adore them. And these people typically want someone who they know is going to actually just look after their clients. So what we tend to do is we'll spread them around the country. So we'll do a reasonably high volume, but they're quite small. So you can really focus on the integration of those clients within the business. And that's perhaps one of the failings I had from previous years, is where you just didn't integrate businesses properly, didn't make sure you're resourced operationally to deliver the service to those clients. So what we did is we just massively resourced ahead of any acquisitions coming in, so we were ready to bring the clients and ready to look after those clients. Because you get one chance, right, to look after these clients when they first come on board. They don't know you. They're being told by their advisor, who they really trust and they love, that we think MKC would be a good home for you. But then we've got to prove it. We've got to earn that trust. And we'll see those clients four or five times in that first year. So that's a massive resource requirement. So we've got to make sure we've got the team in place in order to deliver it.
In terms of kind of the mechanics of that integration, I often wonder kind of how it works on the ground, because there's a lot of kind of heavy lifting tech-wise. You speak about resourcing. What does that look like in practice?
Yeah, so we have an integration team, but it all starts during the due diligence process with the business owner. And I think actually you've got to take it a step even further back than that. It comes back to setting really clear expectations with business owners as to what the world is going to look like post a deal being done. Mm. I think the world has moved on a bit with financial advice. The days of people just, a number of people were told, we'll buy your business, you just carry on doing whatever you want to do, nothing's going to change, don't worry about it. That's just not the case anymore. The world has moved on. That does not work. Those firms are relying on multiple arbitrage for a return. So they said they could buy a business at X and they'd sell it all for Y just because they're a bigger firm. That doesn't work. So we set expectations really clear with business owners. They get really under the bonnet of what does it feel like to be a client in our business? What does that service level feel like? And what we try and do, and what we do is make sure that we buy businesses where ideally clients are paying something like between 1.8 and 2% all-in cost a year. Okay, so that would be something, and they'll have their annual meeting with their advisor, who, as I said, they really like. What we try and do is to lower the overall cost for a client to somewhere between 1.3-1.8% sort of top end. That's all in, including custody, underlying funds, advice, everything, and increase the service. So they go from one meeting a year to full financial plan, monthly update, quarterly portfolio report, 6-month your annual review meeting. So service goes up, cost goes down. Now, if we don't think we can do that, we won't buy the business, right? Because where's the value that we're going to add to that client? So it's about setting those expectations right up front. And then the integration process, once you set those expectations clearly, we're quite a well-trodden path as to the transfer of relationships to the new financial planners within MKC.
Right, yes. And you also have a kind of in-house or MKC Invest, which is your asset management arm. How does the integration work on the investment proposition side of things?
So we have a sister business, MKC Invest, which runs ranges of model portfolios for our clients. We're an independent financial advice business in MKC Wealth. And it all starts off with, I think, the positioning. So I say to our financial planners and everyone in the business, I don't want you to use MKC Invest unless you believe it, right? So unless you believe that it's absolutely the right thing for the client to be in one of those portfolios, don't use it. Don't change what they've got if it's not the right thing to do. So that's about setting the expectations and the culture within the business that only ever do what is absolutely right for the client. And because those portfolios are really well run, they're pretty low cost. I mean, I put my pension into them, for example. So actually, I keep giving the investment managers a bit of pressure under that as well. But we've got to do, if we're not willing to do it ourselves, then why on earth should we be asking our clients to do it? But the process for a client to move into those, it takes time, and only clients where it's a benefit for them would move into them.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's kind of one of the ways that trust that you mentioned can be built with new clients, that they don't see you as some, I don't know, big faceless private equity backed entity, but more a kind of, you know,
it is about trying to build that personal relationship. So, I mean, for example, we talked about integration a second ago. So when we set, before we write to clients, the previous business owner will call every client, let them know that they're merging their business in with us. I will send a letter to all of the clients, but I'll wet sign every letter. Every client has my mobile number, for example. Thankfully, I don't get many calls, because if I was getting calls, that means there's something going wrong usually, but it's that personal touch. We do a load of events during the course of the year so clients can get to know the team of people who are delivering that service. And I was sitting next to some clients at an event we had in Norwich sort of a couple of weeks ago. And it's just about chatting to them and them understanding who the people are that they are trusting to look after their money. So it's about trying to build that personal boutique feel whilst balancing a growing business. So that's the challenge that we have to maintain.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because obviously you've been in M&A for a long time, that you know how this kind of works.
I've made plenty of mistakes in the past, so we're just trying to learn from
that. That was going to kind of be my question.
I thought it might be.
What can go wrong in a merger and acquisition? What are the kind of common pitfalls that you found throughout your career?
I think if you fail to manage expectations, so if you're not being really honest with people as to what life is going to be like post a deal being done. And let's talk, if you're bringing in an existing team of people, you're bringing an office, you're integrating an office, there is going to be change. Right? It's all very tempting to, as someone who is there trying to do a deal and buy a business, to just look someone in the eye and say, don't worry, everything's going to be fine, nothing's going to change. It is going to change, right? There's going to be new back office systems, new processes, different culture. There will be change, and you've just got to make sure you're setting expectations right from the outset and that everybody's clear on it. It often sounds like I'm trying to put people off during the course of a conversation. So you've got about making sure people are aware about what that change looks like. But then also you've got the business owners need to be emotionally ready. There's a big piece around actually, are you ready to relinquish the reins and the control in the business? Because business owners who built it over many years, they can make a decision in the morning and it's implemented by lunchtime, right? That's not how it works once they've sold a business. So they need to be emotionally ready to relinquish control.
Right.
And in many cases, then have a boss. Right. That's difficult for an entrepreneur who's built a business over 20 years. They'd say, well, hang on, I've got a boss now. I mean, we're not quite as sort of rigid as that, but it's a difficult piece for people to get their head around.
Yeah.
So we often make sure, and I've seen lots of people you can tell are not emotionally ready yet to do it. And I'll frankly just say that. I'll say, I just don't think you're quite ready yet. We're not in a rush. We'll be around. Let's talk again in a year.
So you'd be ready to step back.
Oh, yeah. And we do all the time. Mm. All the time. I've done many deals over the years where conversations started 5 or 6 years prior to actually a deal happening. Just because you're building a relationship, getting to know each other, building that trust. And then when someone's actually ready, you can tell when someone really is actually ready.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that I suppose a lot of the books that you buy or retiring advisors, does that help with that aspect of things? If the advisor's not there anymore?
Absolutely. Because a lot of entrepreneurs are unmanageable, right? you can't bring them in and into a business in a sort of more of a structured environment. They find it really difficult. So actually, where there's an environment where they can hand over the client relationships, make sure the clients are happy, and then take the step back and realize the fruits of their labor over many years, that's in my experience when it works the best.
Yeah. So we've spoken a little bit there about the kind of firm that you'd look for on the kind of advisor side. What are the other characteristics of a company that you would look to acquire?
Yeah, so it's a lot around the profile of the client. Does that line up with our target market, where we think we can add the most value to the clients? Because as I said before, if we don't think we're going to be able to add the value to clients, why would we do a deal? Because there's no benefit in there for a client to do so. Thankfully, we think we can add value in most of the cases. But if we're bringing in the team of people, so if we're buying a more established business, merging that in with us, and I know this has become a bit of a buzzword, but you do have to make sure there's the cultural alignment in terms of, is there a shared beliefs in terms of how we look after clients? I do believe that in our sector, people do just generally and genuinely care about the advice that we're doing, right, and the impact that we have on our clients' lives. And actually, we tend to start debating and arguing about just the way in which we're doing it. So we just need to make sure that we're doing it in the right way, and there's an alignment of the culture and people and bringing people in. And if you get that right, and if you're just honest and transparent, then in my experience, it tends to work. Mm. Yeah. But you need to be open about the level of change within a business. We integrate businesses immediately. Right? So, operational processes will change usually, and they'll be on our processes within 3 months of a completion, for example.
Wow. It's interesting, because there are other consolidators who will kind of give a lot more time, try and leave things as they are, and then maybe 12 months.
Yeah, they're kicking a problem down the road, right? So they're kicking a can down the road, in my view. It's a sweeping generalization, right? So there's varying degrees of it. So some people have just said, we are going to rely on the multiple arbitrage, which is a point I mentioned earlier, which is they'll buy at X times, and they'll, just because they're a larger business, they'll be worth Y. I don't think that works anymore. I think if you've got a clear integration plan, and yes, if that takes longer, but as long as everybody in the business is clear on what that looks like, then I think that's fine. Right? We just like to do it, sort of rip the plaster off, as it were, get it done, and then everyone moves on under our processes. But we also can learn from what people are doing. So it's not like a steamroller coming in and just crushing over everything that they've done. You actually take the best bits of each of the businesses you're bringing in to enhance what you're doing as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to come on to that point later in the context of a specific acquisition. But before I do, mentioned a little bit the kind of other players in the consolidation space. There's a lot of chat about the busyness of that market and fears that there might not be the kind of supply of firms to meet the demand of consolidators. What is your kind of view of the market more generally and on that demand point particularly?
Okay. So if we look at it, I think actually, let's look at the problems facing the market. Okay, so let's look at a few of the problems facing our sector. We've got demand for advice is going up, but we've got constrained supply. Yeah, it's costing us more to give advice because of increased regulatory burden than it has ever before. We've got a worsening advice gap. Yeah, so the people's ability to actually access advice is getting harder. We can come on to that in a minute. And there's not enough new entrants into the space in terms of young people coming in. So if you look at those core key problems and those four areas, how do you address those? Now, I firmly believe that if you've got a strong flow of investment into the sector, which we have, I mean, what there's well-publicised 30, 40 private equity-backed businesses that are out there trying to execute a sort of roll-up strategy.
Yeah? As you can see on CityWire's private equity-backed database.
Nice plug there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's some interesting analysis that you guys do then. So that drives that's driving competition, right? So competition, I think, is good for any market because that competition is then driving innovation. But crucially, I think private equity firms that are backing in the sector, I think they've got a much deeper understanding now than perhaps they used to have of the fact that this is a service industry. So you've got the quality of the business is what matters more now than short-term profit. I think people are understanding that. And it's becoming more of a binary decision for investors. So if you've got a bad quality business that's just been cobbled together, they run around, they've acquired loads of businesses, they haven't integrated it, they've got pretty loose controls from a compliance and governance perspective, and they haven't thought about the proposition to the end client, they've just relied on multiple arbitrage, those businesses just aren't really selling, right? So actually those investors are then not getting their return. Actually, it's around if you build a better quality business, we actually just put the client at the heart, deliver the right service, you've got a clear proposition, and you've got a good compliance environment, those businesses are going to do better. But also the ones that innovate and are investing in tech in order to address things like the advice gap, those that have got academies to bring the next generation of talent through into the sector. All of these areas, and I think all of this investment that requires, wouldn't really be possible, I don't think, without the flows of private equity investment that we've seen.
Right. It is investment, but it's also debt. And I wonder, do you ever worry about the kind of amount of leverage in the private equity backed consolidator space?
I think if you're running a business and you've got debt in it, and you're not constantly thinking about making sure you've got the right level of leverage, then you're walking into disaster, right? So I think you've got to be cognizant and really careful as to have we got the appropriate level of leverage in the business. And if you look at what happened with the trust mini budget and rates rocketing as a result of that, that could have had quite material fallout implications for the wider sector. Thankfully, lots of firms were held up as a result of the markets doing pretty well in the following year. So that sort of cushioned the impact from it. But if you're overly levered as a business, then you're going to fall over, and you'll then struggle to invest in the proposition as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry that some of your competitors might be in that position?
But it's interesting you're trying to draw me into that, Joe. But look, I think in the main, people have thought about it pretty carefully and deeply. I'm not close enough to some of the detail, in spite of having looked at some of the data on the CityWire list of leverage in firms. But I think it could create opportunities for other businesses. So if somebody is overly leveraged and then they start struggling, that's going to create opportunities. But then really the issue is going to become what happens to the team and the people in those businesses. Are they going to be left in the lurch? And more importantly, what's going to happen to the clients as well at the end of the day? What we don't want to have is a sort of roundabout of people going in and acquiring firms, then people getting irritated, business not going, and then people leaving. Yes. I just don't think that's very good for the sector at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we've seen before with the collapse of some big firms when, you have these big transfers of advisors and clients so that can it doesn't always end well.
No, and it's massively disruptive, right? It's massively disruptive to the client, it's massively disruptive for the people who are working in those businesses who care passionately in the main about looking after the clients, and then actually because the business perhaps has been mismanaged, these people are then left in the lurch. Mm-hmm. It's a really long-winded way of saying, yeah, obviously you must have a sensible level of leverage in a business.
In MKC context specifically, you are backed by Cabot Square.
Yeah.
I hope I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
How is that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a really good relationship. I mean, when we were trying to get the business, when I was trying to raise the funding for this back in 2021, I was really clear that I wanted to start off by acquiring a small business investing in the infrastructure and the quality, and then growing it. Mm. A lot of the PE backers that I spoke to, or potential PE backers, wanted us just to go and buy something really big, making a minimum level of profit, and then bolt lots of things together really, really quickly. I didn't want to do that approach. So actually Cabot got it immediately, that actually this was all around building long-term value by getting quality and just sort of making sure you're doing it in the right way. They've been a really great backer, really supportive. Yeah, and they're pleased with the progress.
Good. There are some advisors or IFAs who are quite strongly anti PE-backed consolidators. I'm sure you've met your fair share. I know, yeah. I have. And their argument, well, there are lots of arguments, but one common strain will be the kind of motivations of private equity can't align with those of an advisor, because a private equity firm will typically have an investment horizon of 5 years. And whereas an advisor, you know, relationship with the client is for much longer than that. How do you, I suppose, kind of square that?
Yeah, I think that's an outdated view. I think it comes back to this point around private equity firms increasingly having a much deeper understanding of our sector in which we operate, understanding that actually just short-term profits is going to hurt the long-term value of a business because of the fact that these are relationship businesses. It's not a manufacturing sector where it's just around lowering the unit cost of producing widgets. It's around the quality of the relationships with the clients. And actually private equity return, and I think most PE firms are now really clear on this, is that the better the quality of the business that you're building, which has to be focused on therefore the quality of the service to the client, the better their return will be. In fact, we spent a lot of time with our team talking about this as well, going through, you know, £1 million of extra profit a year is worth a lot less than a higher quality business that would command a larger multiple.
To go a little more specific, I think it was 2 months ago now that you acquired Yodeler.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not a typical advice business that it started as a kind of research company. I want to ask a bit about your plans there, because the research arm is a big part of it. And you mentioned at the time that you were looking to invest further in the research arm. What are your ambitions there? Is that to have a kind of in-house research function within MKC?
Well, we've got significant in-house research capabilities already within MKC. What Yodeler does at yodeler.com, what they do is they're producing sort of editorial content, fund analysis for clients online. So people just who are Googling, looking at how their existing funds are performing. So it's very investment-led. And then those clients get that information. They then inquire about having advice, and they are referred into our advice business. So what we see is a lot of clients who've coming through from that website. And in fact, the existing advice business that Yodeler had, so they had the website and then an advice business, but it was quite a small team, but had grown exclusively through leads that had come through from that website. We've integrated the advice business into MKC, and now we're opening it up so that all of those, because they were constrained by capacity, they couldn't service all of the leads coming through. So we've now opened it up to the wider MKC team to then take those initial meetings with these clients. So really, it drives organic growth and new client flow into the MKC business.
Mm. You spoke before about the kind of process before acquiring a company of having that kind of integration team ready to go. In this case, when there was a kind of high volume of leads, how did you prepare?
Yeah, I mean, so it was all around the due diligence is slightly different. So we do our normal due diligence on the advice business. On the online business, it's around understanding what is the content they're putting out there. Are we comfortable with the content that's going out there? Do we think it's appropriate? What does the conversion rates look like of clients coming through from that website? How long do they stick around? How much does it cost in terms of marketing? So it's a different kind of analysis that we had to do there. Mm-hmm. But it's a really good business, and it is growing really fast. Yeah. From an integration perspective, just the advice bit went into our normal team, and the website we are keeping to operate as it is. Albeit we've now got greater capacity to service the leads that come out of it.
On the point of advice firms doing new things or interesting things, there's a lot of talk at the minute about AI. Yeah. There's a lot of talk about tech revolutionising AI, advice as we know it. But a lot of it is kind of promised. I haven't seen so much yet that's got a track record. Within MKC and the different businesses that you see, what most excites you tech-wise?
I'm really excited about what AI can do for our business. I think we're talking to our team about this the other day. We all get together really regularly and just have really frank and open conversations. And we're using AI in a few areas in the business, having tried multiple different systems. You try one, doesn't really work. Let's try another one. So we're in that sort of stage. And we had this team meeting in London the other day. And I think there were 25 AI note takers that we had to reject from the Teams meeting. But we're using it for the note taking in client meetings because it takes the transcripts and it sort of records the actions. We want to then feed that into our fact finding from a client's perspective, just to streamline that part of the process. From a suitability report writing process, I think it's only really at the moment for simple reports, can't do anything complex, but that frees our power planning and technical specialist team up to focus on some of the more complex work whilst actually speeding up business for simple pieces of work. You've then also got it from a compliance file checking point of view and actually putting it through the AI to understand actually where any gaps in any client files. I mean, you do end up being exposed to potential systemic risk if you overly rely on it. So we've obviously got lots of human checks over the top of it. But in the future, what it can do, and if we come back to the point I made earlier around the fact that it is costing us more to give advice now, I do believe that AI should be able to lower the cost. It should lower massively our cost to serve. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I think you've said before that the kind of typical MKC client has around 400,000.
Yeah, about half a million with this.
Half a million. Do you envisage if that kind of cost of advice could be lowered, that with AI that number could come down, that you could look to serve more clients?
We're already looking at what we call our hybrid advice solution for clients with lower levels of investable assets and perhaps simpler needs, and how we can digitize a lot of that advice journey for those clients. So we're already looking at that to make sure that we can serve that segment of clients profitably and at an appropriate price point for them. So we're already doing that. Yes, I think it can do multiple things. You can either lower the threshold of advice of AUA that you're looking after per client, or you can increase the number of clients per advisor, for example, that you're looking after. So there's different ways that you can cut it. Yeah. And we are seeing there are sort of entrants into the sector now who are specializing in servicing some of the smaller clients measured by AUA value.
Yes, I suppose it's increasingly topical as, you know, intergenerational transfer happens and you've got younger clients who maybe don't have the
Henrys, they're now called, aren't they?
Is it? I haven't heard that. Yeah. That's great.
It's high earner, not rich yet.
Very good. Yeah. I'm going to make a note of that one. Yeah. So increasingly important to have that. What would be different about the proposition that you offer for a client for a Henry, for example?
Yeah. So typically, the sort of... And if you look at the end products that you're recommending, they tend to be simpler because there's less complex needs. But really, these clients still want advice. They're in the accumulation stage. They benefit from that advice and you're building a relationship with them. But the advice you're giving tends to be simpler, which means you can therefore use and leverage some of the AI and tech solutions to actually deliver that advice. We believe you still need to have a human involved in that process. So people will drop out of an advice process if, in fact, it's pure robo in the main, and they need a human involved in it. So that's why we call it a hybrid advice process that we're in the process of building at the moment.
Right. In the process of. Are there any more details you can provide?
Yet,
on
no,
it?
No. I like the fishing joke, but no.
We'll stay on touch on that.
Yeah.
Nice. Pivoting slightly, one thing I wanted to talk about is MKC's charity work. You've partnered with, I think, is it three separate charities?
So yeah.
Talk me through the motivation there and
we wanted to establish deeper meaningful partnerships with some charities over a longer period. I'm sure everyone is used to the emails that go around in the office saying, I'm doing this walk, I'm doing this run, I'm climbing this mountain, let's support this charity. So we wanted to have a process where actually let's establish deep partnerships with three charities where we can have more of an impact. So we give everybody in the team 2 days volunteering. So they have 2 days where we pay and they go and volunteer in charities. We ran a selection, there was a sort of a committee who ran a selection panel. We had 10 charities nominated by members of the business. We then reviewed those and picked three charities that we wanted to have a 3-year partnership with. So we made a financial donation to each of them. But then also these are the ones that we felt we could have the most impact in terms of our volunteering time. So we partnered with one charity called Spark, which is based up in the Northwest, which helps young people get into careers, really. So it's around helping and also encouraging entrepreneurialism. So it's really about helping young people who are about to start getting onto the career ladder. Then we've also got the Just Finance Foundation, and we've got a series of children's books that we actually sell on Amazon to help teach children about money. because financial education is just woefully inadequately provided for in schools. Right? It's terrible. And actually, even the Parliamentary Select Committee that reviewed it last year said that it was inadequately provided and recommended a whole load of changes. Anyways, we've got these children's books that we sell out on Amazon. We give them to our clients for free to give them to their children and read them. And we sell them on Amazon, and proceeds from those go directly to Just Finance Foundation, who provide financial education in schools. And then we have another charity, which is called the St. Mark's Debt Charity, which is focused on people who are struggling with debt. So it's sort of the other end of the spectrum, if you like. Yeah. So we've got helping young people with money, because money's become quite intangible. And then also a debt charity for those who are struggling with debt.
Right. How does St. Mark's work? What's the kind of people that you help there and you're involved
with? Yeah, so these tend to be people who are just really up against it and in real dire straits financially. So we might be some of our team will be going there and volunteering, sitting down with them, looking at their finances. Often these people start sticking their head in the sand and you've just got carrier bags full of demands, and it's about going through all of this stuff, sorting it out for them and working out how we can plan their way out of it and get them back onto a stable footing. So that's what St. Mark's Debt Charity does.
Okay, so and it's like financial advice for people who in distress, financial distress.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, yeah.
Great, okay, yeah. One last question, if you don't mind, about the kind of next stage for MKC. So it's been, how many years now?
Four years.
As we were talking about earlier, you've grown quickly. What comes next? What do the next 12 months, 24 months look like?
More of the same. We're carrying on. We're continuing to invest in the IT, in the background, the proposition, the service, continue to sort of support the development of the team. So we would just carry on doing what we're doing. It's working. Our clients are happy. I still think there's always more we could do. I'll never be fully satisfied. And that's going to be the gist of it, is around what are the extra things we can be doing for our clients. And we will continue to grow both inorganically and organically. Yeah.
And you expect more acquisitions this year?
Yeah, sorry, that's the inorganic bit. Yeah, so there will be more acquisitions. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, look forward to seeing them come through.
Okay. Well,
thanks so much,
Jay,
for your time.
Well, look, thank you very much for having me, Jay.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.